Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Then all the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." What we see here is that the outcasts, the worst of the worst, are drawn to Jesus. The tax collectors who were hated by all, and those who lived in obvious and visible sin. Unlike the Pharisees, Jesus didn't reject them, but he received them. More than that, it says he ate with them, which was a sign of his hospitality to them. And as they observed this, the Pharisees grumbled, they muttered, they complained. They said, "This man receives sinners, he eats with them." And to them, this was another strike against Jesus. Continuing with verse 3 and then verse 11, "So Jesus spoke this parable to them, saying, 'A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided to them his livelihood.'" So this idea behind portion of goods is essentially the share of the inheritance. And for the younger son, according to the Old Testament law, this share would be one-third of the estate. Now, typically, then as today, an estate, an inheritance, was received upon the death of the owner. But it was not a totally unusual arrangement for this to be done during the lifetime of a person at this time. So in this case, during the lifetime of his father. The understanding would be this, that the father would continue to live on the estate. The father would continue to retain income produced by the estate until death, but the estate would be managed by those to whom he was sharing this inheritance. So he divides it. He divides it over his two sons. The older son gets two-thirds of the estate. The younger gets one-third of the estate. And this would be a workable arrangement, except verse 13. "Not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living." The idea behind this phrase, "gathered all together," is not that he had belongings within the household that he was taking with him, but rather he is converting one-third of his father's property to cash. He's cashing out. Now, with this cash out, the estate would now produce one-third less, which now affects his father and affects his older brother and the entirety of the family. At the same time, the local community would not have been all that interested in buying this property because they knew what was taking place. So it required a less than ethical buyer to buy it, and probably at a less than optimal price, because this was a quick cash transaction. And this younger son's intent for it is made clear immediately. It says he journeyed to a far country. And the idea here is he's going as far away as he could possibly go. Why? So that he would have the freedom to indulge himself in all the ways that he had not previously been allowed in his father's home, and without now as well the attention and the talk of his local community. He could do whatever he wanted because his dad couldn't tell him he couldn't, and he'd have no one in the community trying to rein him in. It says he wasted his possessions with prodigal living. And this is the idea of the lusts and desires, not just of youth, but also of the depraved, sinful flesh. And it's been freed of the father's restraint. It is the love of the world to which the Apostle John refers in 1 John chapter 2, beginning with verse 15. "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Verse 16 is this prodigal son. "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world." Now, unlike we believers who live in this constant battle between our sinful flesh and the Christ life in us, tempted to live with a foot in both kingdoms, this young man is being described as going all in. He's putting both of his feet, his entire person, in the position of the world. And he's going to spare no expense in his time there. He had resented his father's household rules. He resented his lack of independence. He imagined that somewhere out there in this great big world was the freedom that would bring him happiness. And the sin nature, the world, the devil, they will all promise happiness to us, but they deliver misery. Verse 14 and following. But when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine, and he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. Having spared no expense, remember he has a third of his father's estate, he spent it all on empty promises and temporary pleasures. But having chased these pleasures, he instead found pain. And there was a severe famine in that land. Now keep in mind, he's gone as far away from home as possible. He is in a foreign land. He is a foreigner. But he's not even an immigrant. He's simply a tourist. And a severe famine left nothing for even a resident of that country, let alone the tourist. So now, having spent all, he has no home. He has no food. He has no hope. And it would not be unreasonable to expect him to go home right now. But either shame or pride disallowed this. So he joined himself to a citizen of that country. This is not a job interview. This is attaching himself to a stranger who had no desire to deal with him. It is him in a position of begging, saying, "Please, sir, help me. I have no help. I have no hope." And this man saying, "Get out of here. I have enough problems. I don't need a foreigner like you attaching yourself to me." But it says the young man glued himself to him. He would not leave. He just kept begging. He harassed this man for any kind of help. And finally, this man caves. He says, "Okay, you want to help? I'll tell you what you can do. You can feed my swine." Now, if he happened to know that this young man was a Jew, maybe he thought the young man wouldn't do this job. Because this, to a Jew, would have been the lowest of vocations. Pigs were unclean animals. Maybe he would just go away, but he didn't go away. He went to the pigs. And that was terrible. But it was worse than that. Because here's what he discovered when he went to the pigs. He discovered the pigs were better cared for than he was. They actually had food. Now, the food were pods. They were outer husks of a seed-bearing plant, but it was food. And these pods made his empty stomach growl. In other words, he was starting to become something more akin to a pig than a man. He was even considering joining the pigs in their feast on their pods. No one gave him anything. Turns out that when he had money, he had friends in this foreign land. But they weren't really his friends. They were simply leeches who had attached themselves to him for his money. And when the money was gone, so were they. He had chased pleasure. What did he find? He found pain. He chased freedom. What did he find? He found bondage. In his father's house, he was a son. In this foreign land, he had become nearly a slave. His wages were fighting pigs for refuse. So now this young man is starving. You can almost imagine him as being just skin and bones at this point. But he's rolling around with pigs, which means he's covered with filth. He's likely sick with disease from feeding with these pigs. And as he's rolling around with the pigs, starving, sick, covered in filth, his mind is cast back to pleasant memories of childhood, where he had not just a home, but he had a grand home. He was part of an estate. And he remembered fun times with his older brother. He remembered that his father had all these servants who cared for both of them. More than that, they had a father who loved them, and a love so generous that even when he would go to his father and more or less wish him dead, saying, "You know what, I would rather have your money than your love," even then his father would not deny him the inheritance to spend as he saw fit, no conditions. And that's when he began to consider that maybe his decisions up until this point were not just bad, they were actual insanity. Because in verse 17 it says, "But when he came to himself," in other words, he starts to realize, rolling around with the pigs, "I have not been in my right mind." And he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare? And I perish here with hunger." To exchange his father and his home for sin and its consequences, he's realizing now, that was insane. That makes no sense. And it's even more insane that he's eating with pigs. He could have gone home already. He's recognizing everything he's doing is totally insane. Not only his father and his brother are better off, he's saying even the household servants are in a far better position than he. They could eat whenever they needed to eat. Not only that, they had leftovers. They had leftovers of the great meal they had the previous day, the next day. And he says, "I perish here with hunger." Right now he realizes there are only two places he can go. He can go to Sheol, the place of the dead, to Hades, to death, or, verse 18, "I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he comes to himself. His insanity is now broken. He comes into his right mind, and in his right mind, he remembers the face of his father. He remembers the character of his father. His father, who just showed him enormous, boundless love, extreme kindness, generous mercy, amazing grace. And he was filled with a courage to do the unthinkable. "I perish with hunger." He could go to Hades or he could go home. So he developed a plan. He knew that his father was a man of amazing grace, but he also knew that what he had done to his father was beyond the pale. He had sinned grievously, such that his father's house was most certainly closed to him, let alone heaven. So he planned to say, "Father, you deserve a far better son than I have been or ever could be. Maybe a son like my brother. He stayed with you. He was always the good son. My sin is such that I can no longer be a son, but find it in your amazing grace to let me be your servant. I'll work the rest of my life to pay off my debt. I promise I won't live off my brother's estate. I'm not going to take from your income. I will only do whatever I can to improve the position of the estate. I know that I can never pay this off. I know that as a servant, I'll never make up a third of the estate. It can never be enough. But Father, it can be something." And if this were the end of the parable, the Pharisees and the scribes to whom Jesus shared this parable would have said, yeah, okay, I can get behind that. The tax collectors and sinners, yeah, they're not really sons, but they should work off their debt, something akin to, I'll forgive you, but I'll never forget. In other words, I'll forgive you, but you always owe something. If you don't forgive at all, or if you forgive with ongoing conditions, there are people in this gospel that you reflect, and it's not Jesus. But Jesus didn't end the parable there. Verse 20, and he arose and came to his father from among the pigs, out of the pig's sty, for a return trip. Now keep in mind, he had gone as far away as was possible. This skeleton of a man must now return that same distance to his home. And so he walks, and he walks, and he walks, and he walks on, and he's near starvation. He is covered in filth. He is diseased. He is insect-ridden. He probably has festering wounds all over his body. His lips are chapped, and they are broken. He was now, to the eyes of any who saw him traveling, more beast than man in appearance. And as he walked, he rehearsed his speech. And to anyone who came in contact him, it would have sounded like the ravings of a lunatic as he mumbled, I've sinned against God. I've sinned against you. You deserve a better son. My brother. I guess he's really disappointed in me too. He has every right to be. I could be a servant. I'll work hard. I'll pay back everything I can. I know it'll never be enough. And he walks and walks and rehearses his speech. Verse 20. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. Still a great way off, his father saw him, which means what? It means that every single day that his son has been gone, he has gone out to the road and he has looked in the hopes of seeing his son return. We could be talking days, we could be talking weeks, we could be talking months, we could be talking years, and every day this father went out and looked and he hoped. And then one day, off in the distance, he sees some beast shuffling slowly towards the estate, someone who would have been unrecognizable to anyone except a father or a mother. Why? 1 Corinthians 13:13, and now abide faith, hope, love, these three, but the greatest of these is love. And love instantly knows its beloved, because the father's vision is not blurred by hatred for his son. The father's vision is not blurred by a desire to get vengeance for what his son has done. Each day there was just one thing that drove this father to the road to watch, and it was simply this. It was love. And now the day he had long hoped for had come, and the word tells us he had compassion, which in Greek is literally his guts moved. His guts moved. He felt it in his gut. That strange feeling of enormous joy and enormous nausea and enormous butterflies and all those things that you get in your gut when you feel an emotion so deep that your gut tells you what it is in a way that your mind cannot and your mouth can't utter. And the father can't contain himself. He can't wait. The picture here is he hitches up his robes and he runs and he runs and he runs. And as soon as he approaches this shuffling beast who was his son, he embraced him and he pulled him as close as he possibly could. And it's a tough picture. He showers him with kisses. Now keep in mind, this son was the picture of filth. He was disgusting. His beard would have grown out. It would have been covered with lice. And this father is kissing him and weeping over him. And this is all before his son could even open his mouth. And through chapped and broken lips, the son's mouth parched with thirst, he croaked out the speech he had been rehearsing for days, for weeks, for months, for many miles from a far country. He croaks out, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son." It's the rehearsed speech, but you'll note that there's a big omission. In the arms of his father, a reality far greater than anything he has ever experienced so far in his life hits him dead between the eyes. He realizes in this moment he could work not just his entire life, but all of eternity, and not just eternity, but multiple eternities, and he could never do enough to pay back his debt. He could never do enough to earn this love that up until this point he had always taken for granted. But now in the arms of a father who embraced him and kissed him and wept in joy for his return, despite the insane levels of sin he had committed, he was reduced to a single truth. And the truth is this: I am not worthy. Period. That's it. Amazed by his father's grace, the young man was reduced to the only appropriate response to such amazing grace: repentance. Regardless of the young man's intent, the father wasn't going to let him say anything else anyway. Verse 22, "But the father said to his servants, 'Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet.'" This wasn't just any robe. This is the best robe. This father would have this son be nothing less than distinguished. He said, "Put a ring on his hand." And you may recall now the story of Pharaoh and Joseph. And when Pharaoh made Joseph second in command over all of Egypt, what was the sign that he placed upon him of this delegated authority? It was Pharaoh's signet ring. Here the father is not just restoring the son as his son, but also as a son who has the full authority over the household. And even in the local community, this son would continue to speak in authority for his house. And amazingly, considering his particular sin, the ring also meant his credit is good here. He could spend whatever he wanted to spend, it would be charged to the household account. And finally, sandals on his feet, because only slaves went barefoot. And this man is not a slave, this man is my son. A little theological aside to this part: early church fathers viewed all of these things as an allegory for salvation. The robe of Christ's righteousness, the ring, the testimony of the Holy Spirit that a believer is now a son of God, as Paul says in Galatians 4:6, "Because you are sons, God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying out, 'Abba, Father,'" and the sandals, the capacity to now walk in God's ways in holy obedience. So the father places upon him a robe, a ring, and sandals, and yet the father is still not done. Verses 23 and 24, "And bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to be merry. The fatted calf, this was the best of the best, reserved for the biggest of feasts. And if you want to continue down allegorical roads, if you look closely, you may even see here the fatted calf of sacrifice given by the father to atone for the sins of the son. So if you're looking for Jesus in this parable, you may have just found him in the fatted calf. Allegorically then, it's all here. The forgiveness of sins, redemption from slavery to sin, justification, which is being made right with the Father, adoption, no longer a slave but a son, dead in sins but now alive, lost now found. They made merry, they rejoiced, and specifically they did it through the means of feasting, of table fellowship. Remember the Pharisees' complaint? This man receives sinners and what? Eats with them. Which bridges us now to the rest of the parable, because even now, we have not yet actually reached Jesus' central point, his central question of those who are hearing this parable. Verses 25 to 27. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, "Your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf." So what's the older son doing right now? He's in the field. He's attending to the business of managing the estate. But as he's in the field working, he hears some noise. He hears music. And wait, is that the sound of like dancing? The sound of celebration? He doesn't like the sound of it, because any celebration was his responsibility to manage, to determine. So what was this? And deep in his heart, he knew exactly what it was. And his servant just now confirmed what he feared. His no good brother was back. And of course he was. Because of course he blew it. And of course he's here hat in hand. And of course my soft-hearted, mushy-headed father fell for it again. Not only did he fall for it, but this time he actually killed the fatted calf for it. And he thinks to himself, what my brother did is unforgivable. And frankly, father is at best an enabler. At worst, he has even gone so far as to compromise the estate yet again. And the future of my estate. To the older son, it felt like a betrayal. Verse 28, but he was angry and would not go in. Therefore, his father came out and pleaded with him. The entire community was celebrating, and the older brother was notably absent from the feast. The father asked the servants what was going on, and when he heard that his older son was angry, he left the celebration to plead with him, to plead with him. Verses 29 and 30. So he answered and said to his father, "Lo, these many years I have been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him." Now you notice here, when the younger son comes to his father, he calls him father. He addresses him with the title. But the older son addresses his father in this way. He says, "Look here." Then he says, "These many years I have been serving you." You know what the Greek word is there? Slaved. He says, "Look here. I've been slaving for you a long time. Now, all the work that he ever did on the estate was ultimately going to benefit him, was going to benefit his future. And yet, the older son resented his father to the degree that he saw this work, which would benefit him, as slavery. And he says, "I never transgressed your commandment at any time," despite the fact that right now he was doing it. His father said, "Come in." He's not going to come in. He's disobeying his father. He's dishonoring his father at the feast. And dared say, "I never did anything wrong." And then he says, "You never even gave me a young goat." In other words, you never once even minimally celebrated me that I might make merry with my friends. In other words, he's saying, "I find no joy in this family. I find only joy in my friends. I find no joy in the return, the restoration of my brother. But I have friends. And as soon as this son of yours came, meaning whatever my brother is and you are to me, I'm going to tell you this much. You're not family. Your son has devoured your livelihood with harlots. Now, interestingly, Jesus never actually tells us that this is the case. It may have been. But from the mouth of the older brother, it's just a baseless accusation. It's an assumption. He's imagined scenarios. He's made up stories in his mind about his brother while he was away. And he says, "You killed the fatted calf for him." And in saying that, he's asking this question: why should I have done anything at all ever if the prodigal is the one who gets the party? So remember the younger son. The younger son says to his father, "You deserve a better son." The older son says to his father, "I deserve a better father." The younger son says to his father, "I am not worthy of you." The older son to his father, "You are not worthy of me." And the father to his older son, this is amazing, because he has been deeply insulted by his older son, but instead of anger at his older son's wickedness, even now he shows amazing grace, 31 and 32, and he said to him, "Son, you are always with me. All that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again and was lost and is found. Son, you are always with me." Son, when he had not been addressed as father, but has been addressed as "look here." When his son said to him, "I have been slaving for you, slave master," yet he calls him a son. And by calling him a son, he's saying, "Your place in my house is secure. Your inheritance is secure. It's all yours. In fact, your daily reward was, you were always with me and I was always with you. What's better than that?" The return of your brother doesn't change that. Instead, we should make merry and be glad, and you should join the feast, because your brother was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And amazingly, the parable ends right there. That's it. But it ends, when you remember the audience, with an implied question. And this implied question is one which every single one of us must answer. And the question is this: will you join the feast? Will you humbly join the feast, knowing that your invitation is by amazing grace alone, that you can only receive the invitation through faith alone, and all and only for the sake of Christ alone? Will you now feast on this undeserved amazing grace, which is so sweet, as we sang earlier? Or will you self-righteously refuse the feast because the other people invited to the feast don't live up to your standards? Does undeserved amazing grace not taste sweet to you, but actually sour? Because whatever you intellectually assent to, agree to, if you won't forgive, God's amazing grace tastes sour to you. It tastes bitter to you. It's very easy to love the prodigal part of this parable for ourselves, to see God's amazing grace for us, that God has saved us when we did not deserve it. But it's way harder to love that prodigal part of the parable for other people. Amazing grace saved a wretch like me, but at least I'm not as wretched as those other guys. Then all of a sudden, we aren't so much undeserving of that God's grace, but we're more deserving of God's grace. And rather than rejoicing daily in the fact that we've been treated better than we deserve, we angrily stand outside the feast, convinced we deserve to be treated better. Boiled down to their essence, every problem, every conflict, every strained relationship have only two possible solutions for the Christian: repentance and forgiveness. Those are your only two options. Grace will always be a strong taste to you. It's either going to be amazingly sweet or it's going to be amazingly sour. To the sin-sick soul who confesses, "I am not worthy," God's amazing grace is sweet. To the self-righteous soul who demands that everyone else do better, including God himself, his amazing grace is sour. Prodigal or proud, it is by grace alone that you are saved. You've been invited to an eternal feast. Turn from your prodigal sins. Turn from your proud sins. Taste of God's grace so sweet, and come in. Join the wedding feast, which has no end. Amen.